4 years ago today, Russia launched the largest land war Europe has seen since World War II. We still argue about why. Putin's personal radicalization, the long shadow of Soviet collapse, an institutional culture that generates aggression from below, with or without orders from above, the West's empty promises to a country it was never prepared to defend. These explanations aren't mutually exclusive, but they point in different directions when it comes to assigning responsibility and deciding what, if anything, could have prevented this war. At the center of it all is a man some analysts treat as inscrutable, a cold, calculating strategist whose real thinking happens behind closed doors. Or maybe Putin's an open book, not a black box. 4 years into the war he started, we're still trying to figure out who he is, what he really wants, and whether any of this could have gone differently. So on the fourth anniversary of this horrible invasion, let's talk again about why Russia invaded Ukraine. Welcome to the Naked Pravda. Howdy, folks. I'm your host, Kevin Rothrock, managing editor of Ms. in English. Today's guest is Lucian Kim, a journalist who has been covering Russia since Putin's first term in office. He's got an impressive resume with more than two decades reporting from inside the country, including time in the Kremlin press pool. Most recently, he was National Public Radio's Moscow-based correspondent, and today he works as a senior Ukraine analyst at the International Crisis Group. And his book, Putin's Revenge, Why Russia Invaded Ukraine, is now available in paperback. In fact, if you check the show notes for this podcast episode, you'll find a hyperlink for the book at Columbia University Press, and you can even use a promo code. I don't usually do this, but I've got a promo code for you today, CUP20, CUP20. Use that promo code, and you'll get a 20% discount. Okay, so with a book called Putin's Revenge, my first question to the author was about methodology. How does somebody reconstruct the internal decision-making of a man like Vladimir Putin? So, first question, I thought I'd just sort of like lead in with a question about methodology. And if this characterization of the book's argument is off at all, let me know. But my reading is that the book's argument is that Putin's personal radicalization is the main driver of the invasion of Ukraine, that this is largely the result of like this one man's obsession, and it translates into a war of choice, totally unnecessary war, a war that most or every other Russian leader, certainly democratic leader, would never have picked. So on the Ukrainian side of the story, you've got this rich sourcing, you've got lots of access, lots of original content, interviews, and so on. And then when it comes to the Russian side, you have Putin's public speeches, you've got scenes reconstructed from the Kremlin's own propaganda documentaries and so on, and where you point out the lies and the manipulations and so on. And you have assessments by Western intelligence officials of Putin's state of mind and lots of like reconstructions of internal decision making based on work by like Mikhail Ziegler and Catherine Belton, handful of other secondary accounts written by journalists who are essentially facing the same access problem that you and everybody else have. So I wonder, you don't have and you can't have direct testimony from anybody who's sitting in the room with Putin when he's making these decisions. How do you write a book whose main thesis is all about this one man's psychology when that guy's, you know, inner world, when Putin's inner world is essentially a black box?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. The thesis of the book is actually you were focused on one part of it. I mean, the second part of it, and I present it the other way around, is that the root causes really for this war are Russian imperialism, this idea that Russia has this historic role to play, whether it's as the Soviet Union, whether it's as the Russian Empire, or now the Russian Federation as a sort of a unifying power in Eurasia. That's the kind of the driving idea behind it. So that exists, and that is certainly important for millions of Russians. However, my argument is that alone, this idea of post-imperial trauma, that is not enough to drive Russia to go to war. And the second part, a key part, is Russia's descent into dictatorship, and that is what made this war possible. And that is objectively true, that Vladimir Putin went down this path, beginning as a leader who was widely seen as a reformer, someone you could do business with, incidentally, also by many Ukrainians. And he went through this evolution or devolution, where at the end, he decides that the only thing that he can do is invade his neighbor. And so I think it's the combination of those two things. Neither can happen on their own, right? I mean, it wasn't just Putin's decision. Of course, he had to rely on some kind of feeling that was in society. But certainly just the fact that people were traumatized by the fall of the Soviet Union was not enough to do it.
How confident are you in your triangulation of his inner thinking? Like, do you feel as though, I guess to some degree, this is like trying to boil down some like essence of his mind or something. But do you feel like he says what he means and we can read his speeches and understand him from that? Or do you feel like the Ziegers and the Beltons of the world are able to zero in on the truth through their sourcing and so on? Like, what's your kind of confidence level of like our ability to grasp Putin's mind?
You know, I've been covering Vladimir Putin since 2003, so his first term in office. And of course, there's always been a lot of speculation about, you know, he's a three-dimensional or four-dimensional chess player, and he's always thinking around curves and is sort of this evil mastermind that and nobody really knows what he's thinking. And I've always felt, as a journalist who's also been part of his pool and been in the room with him, even in very small rooms with Putin, first of all, I have that experience, but I have always maintained that actually Putin is in some ways very transparent. I mean, you can find every speech that he has given practically in his entire career as Russia's leader online. Often you can find it on video. And he is the kind of leader who does a lot of signaling and says what he thinks. It's not really a big mystery. And I think when you just use that as your sample size, first of all, it's very huge. And you can actually see this progression, you know, or an evolution of his thinking. So I think we actually have a lot to work with. He is also often characterized as being, you know, very cool and calculating. And in fact, he is often very emotional. And the way he comes across in his statements on television, you can interpret. I mean, you don't even need to interpret. You can see how he's reacting. I mean, just one tiny example that comes to mind right now is when Joe Biden, at the beginning of his term, referred in an interview to Putin as a killer. Well, actually, the question was, do you consider him a killer? And Joe Biden indicated that he did. And this really grated on Putin. And he came out and made one first reaction. And then later that same day, he hadn't had enough. And he went back on state TV. He was behind the scenes of some event. And he dug in even further because it had annoyed him so much. And it had offended him so deeply. So he reacts to things, and you can see this. He is not a black box. And there's been a lot of excellent reporting. I mean, you mentioned a couple of fantastic colleagues, and really there's also many more colleagues who have written about his time, for example, in COVID isolation. And obviously everything is a reconstruction that we do in journalism, but a lot of this is also factually based, right? The fact that he was very isolated, that he is a germaphobe, that he required people to go into quarantine, many days of quarantine before seeing him, and that he was surrounded by really a very, very small group of people who we know objectively are hardline Russian imperialists.
I don't know if you saw, but Farida Rustamova recently reported that he's finally out of COVID isolation. He's not making people self-isolate anymore. Do you think that we're going to get a more enlightened and softer Putin as a result, or it's hardwired in now?
I do think that was just one element of his being, but I don't expect a softer or a kinder, gentler Putin to come out of that.
Okay, all right. Some like terrible old men like become kind of like gentle when they get old. I don't know. Maybe Putin will become like a really soft great grandpa when he gets like to 80 or something. That's probably wishful thinking. Another question. You have this, I mean, you're a witness to the annexation of Crimea, to the Russian seizure of it with troops and so on. In my opinion, it's the best chapter of the book. It's like really fascinating to read your firsthand eyewitness account of all this happening. Why do you think that Putin stops short of ordering a full-scale invasion of Ukraine there and then in 2014? Because we also get insights into, in the book, we get your insights into Ukrainian decision-making, and we find that it seems as though the country would have collapsed if Russia had actually sent its army in at this point. You know, you've got acting President Alexander Turchynov claiming that he prevents the wider Russian invasion by slow-walking the Ukrainian military's expulsion from Crimea. Do you see, are there like counterfactuals here where you're like, wow, it really could have gone a different direction if only Putin had acted sooner? Why didn't he act sooner? What's your reading here?
In my book, I present several hypotheses, which remain such because we cannot prove them with hard documentation, with archival material. One of my hypotheses is that there was a concrete Crimea plan to take Crimea. And of course, all militaries prepare for all sorts of wild contingencies. But I think in the Kremlin, and I also mentioned this in the book, there probably was an idea of taking Crimea, not necessarily because of the Maidan, but elections were coming up, presidential elections were coming up in Ukraine in 2015. And the Kremlin was certainly expecting a really harsh political battle. And I think at that point, they realized maybe we need to have a plan for Crimea just in case, because the way that it was executed was truly masterful. I think you can say that objectively. It was done with very little bloodshed, and it was done highly professionally from a military point of view. So I think Crimea was part of the plan, and certainly something that the Kremlin had thought through. As far as taking the Donbass or taking all of Ukraine, invading all of Ukraine, I don't believe that that was ever part of the plan. I think Crimea was a very cut and dry thing. And Donbass, as I also show, and I believe that many of my colleagues who have studied this would come to this agreement, that Donbass in some ways was an afterthought. It was freelancers went in. The Kremlin was waiting to see what would happen and what certainly their proxies and their allies in Ukraine were capable of doing. So I don't think it was part of the plan. As I show in the book, of course, the Ukrainian leadership was very afraid once Crimea started that that could trigger a full-scale invasion. And as far as my understanding is, at that point, the threat of full-scale invasion was simply, it was more demonstrative. It was done to create threats all around Ukraine, to distract also from Crimea, and also very important to send a signal to Western countries that, you know, this don't touch us. We know what we're doing, and don't make this problem even worse. What's interesting, I think, when we look now with the hindsight of the full-scale invasion that started in 2022, 4 years ago, and I'm sure in some ways Putin is kicking himself, he could have invaded in 2014. I mean, the Ukrainians were acutely aware of this, that he could have marched on Kyiv within a day, and that was actually a possibility. It was not merely theoretical. Ukraine had no army to speak of. And I think even more importantly, psychologically, Ukrainians were not yet at that point where they saw Russia as an enemy and as an adversary, certainly the majority of Ukrainians. So a surprise attack in 2014 would have worked. I think we can say that in hindsight. I think most Ukrainians would agree with that. But the reason it didn't happen was because Putin thought he could achieve what he wanted in Ukraine by other means, and I think he also decided that at that point it was to say, Crimea is no longer Ukrainian. Stop saying it's, but Ukraine as a you know, Ukraine without Crimea is still a state that we can try to influence through soft power, and if need be, through this kind of hybrid warfare.
You mentioned freelancing, that this is in Crimea, that the Kremlin's agents, they essentially have freelancers across Ukraine, and that's guiding a lot of the intervention and meddling at this point. And you document in really great detail how people like Gherkin and Malafeyev, Baradai, Glazyev, Surkov, they're operating in Ukraine with varying degrees of sort of Kremlin authorization, freelancing the Donbass like Gherkin. Surkov is running these covert negotiations in Kyiv. Glazyev's coordinating rallies by phone and then Malafeyev's bankrolling operations with, through his Orthodox charity. And you have a lot of interesting, you get multiple chapters even about like how this sort of operation's working. And you borrow Mark Galeotti's adhocracy framing, that it's informal actors, you know, vying for the Kremlin's favor, competition among freelancers and so on, more than a coherent plan necessarily. Although obviously in Crimea, there really is a pretty coherent plan. I wonder, what do you think this does for culpability? Because the book's title is Putin's Revenge. So we've got possessive there. This belongs to Putin to a large degree. But if Russia's system is based less on sort of like top-down decision-making and is actually driven by this institutional culture where it kind of produces aggression without anybody needing to sign off on it, and then the Kremlin can kind of swoop in and claim credit for successful operations. Like, what does this do for who we can hold responsible for everything that's happened? That seems like it spreads it pretty wide.
Sure. Obviously, there are many authors and perpetrators in the Russian aggression toward Ukraine. As far as the Crimean operation, I also refer to it in my book. 1 year after the annexation of Crimea, Russian state TV came out with this documentary, I might call it more like a docufiction or mockumentary, in which Putin portrays his idea of the, or his version of the annexation. And we see that he personally, right, directed the so-called evacuation of Yanukovych from Crimea and then the decision to go ahead and send in troops. So this was he himself, he takes all the credit for what happened in Crimea. I think it is still his revenge. I mean, obviously it's a revenge of many people who felt especially hurt by the fall of the Soviet Union, including people like Alexander Borodai or Igor Girkin, as you mentioned. But they saw the signal. And, you know, when you read what Igor Girkin said at the time and also later, he was actually deeply skeptical of Putin. And when the Crimea annexation...
Yeah, it's no mystery why he's in jail now.
Exactly. And when the Crimean annexation happened, he saw that as a signal and as a validation. And he thought that in some ways, like Alexei Navalny, he thought that there was a corrupt clique that had usurped power in Russia. And he saw that this was a moment where suddenly they were doing what he had always dreamt of, namely collecting these former Russian lands. And so in some sense, Igor Girkin is really maybe the most interesting example because he ran off and did his thing. He tried to get funding and support from Konstantin Malafeyev, whom he knew personally, and did not actually get that blessing to go into the Donbass. And so he just was doing his own thing. So of course, he bears huge responsibility for what ended up being the war in Donbass. I don't think there's a contradiction because, I mean, Putin still made all of that possible himself.
You mentioned I can't remember if it's a chapter or if it's a section where you argue that Putin effectively kidnapped Yanukovych. And I wanted to ask, you lay out kind of how Yanukovych is bouncing around from, he tries to retreat to his stronghold, right? And he keeps getting rejected and turned away. And it sounds as though the officials in Kiev are genuinely trying to capture him. And there's like a genuine threat of, if not violence, then at least like apprehension. And you say that the FSO, the Russian FSO, Federal Security, not service.
The Guard Protective Service. Yeah, exactly.
Right. They fabricate an assassination threat to bring him in. And then once he's in Russian custody, it's sort of over for him. But when I was reading this, I was thinking, okay, like they're putting their finger on the scale to get him over to their side. But it still sounds like a rescue to some degree because he really sounds like he's backed into a corner. And so can you explain like the significance of this being a kidnapping and not an extraction if Yanukovych didn't really have a choice? It still looks to me like a rescue. I'm not like clapping my hands about it, but just in terms of the logistics.
Well, that is certainly another one of the hypotheses I put forward. We will not have all the documentation. And this is based on what Putin himself said in this state television film about the annexation of Crimea, plus based on testimony that Yanukovych's bodyguards gave during his treason trial in Kiev. I still think it's a kidnapping because he didn't necessarily want to. It seems like Yanukovych, when he left Kiev, he thought he was still in charge. He went to Kharkiv. from Kharkiv, and he realized that he was already beginning to lose control. If he had wanted to go to Russia or escape, he could have just gotten into his helicopter and flown for 1 or 2 minutes and been in Russian airspace. He did not do that. Instead, he decided to go on this, what he described as a tour of southeastern Ukraine. And it seems like his own idea was very muddled. That's certainly true. But it seemed like he did not want to leave himself at that time. And then he gave this interview also to the BBC once he was in Russia, where he indicates that he didn't really play much of a role in his own extraction. And I think that's why I put that forward. Now, I think your question is really good. So why would Putin have done this? Why did he need to do this? And I think the extraction of Yanukovych is actually key, because it shows, first of all, that there was a plan to take Crimea. It's in the documentary film that Putin puts out there. He actually says, you know, we decided at that moment, actually when they began taking out Yanukovych, that they had to save Crimea from some threats that were actually just imaginary or a pretext. And the reason they needed to extract Yanukovych, and, you know, it may have ended up being a rescue in some ways from the Ukrainian authorities, but the Russians absolutely needed Yanukovych out of the country for two reasons. First of all, they were putting in their own puppet government in Crimea. And because they do everything according to their interpretation of the law, they certainly needed the signature of the Ukrainian president to approve their new puppet government. And one thing I found out was they produced a fax with Yanukovych's signature approving of the new puppet government led by Sergei Aksionov. So they needed him for that. And then they needed him for a second thing. They needed him to ask Russia for military help. And there is also a document there, what, as my colleague Stephen Lee Myers from the New York Times found out, he was actually forced to sign that document retroactively. So actually after the Russians had gone to the UN and held up the sheet of paper saying Yanukovych himself is asking for Russian troops to be sent to Ukraine, he actually signed that document, I believe, the day after. And that was when he got his first personal audience with Putin, by the way.
I realize that what I've been asking you has a lot, it's a lot of it is like assailing this notion that, like, oh, how did Putin run the whole thing by himself? Like, why did he get all the blame and so on? But in fact, your book, of course, is not that. And it actually frames the conflict. One of the like big variables that you're looking at is generational clashes. And in this case, the generational clash is between those, as you write, who had freed themselves from the Soviet mindset and those who were still captive to it. And you include lots of, you know, vivid material about young Moscovites, you know, at Bolotnaya, Ukrainian students on the Maidan and so on, who have no memory of the Soviet Union. They're these like fundamentally new political actors. But I want to ask, why did you decide that generation carries so much explanatory weight when, in fact, reading your book, I thought you're noting other variables that I thought seemed like just as powerful, maybe. We get some really like vivid class portraits of people, these middle-class Moscovites, these industrial, you know, young men in Donetsk whose faces are marked like poverty and they're missing teeth and so on. And I know that you're also, you make a point of pushing back against just dividing it into language and regional, you know, differences, which is something obviously that like is built up into a straw man argument for a lot of people to say, oh, well, look at the language barrier. That explains the whole thing in Ukraine. And so that's obviously oversimplified, but like, there are like regional economic differences that would presumably make it so that like a 25-year-old IT professional in Kiev is not the same as a 25-year-old miner in Donetsk. And you also write, actually, it's one of the fascinating things that I didn't know very much about, but I know it's very important. I felt guilty for not knowing more, is the oligarchic structure of Ukrainian politics and how oligarchs at various points are sort of intervening to move the needle on big historical events happening in Ukraine. But to me, they came across in the story more as kind of like, they're like actors in the story. They appear, they make a decision, and then they kind of go away. they're not a structural feature that's sort of shaping history or sort of the mass attitudes of Ukrainians. And I wonder, what about like patronage networks? Maybe that's like a really like fruitful way to try to understand like how Ukrainian politics develops. So I guess like, could you explain for me how you came to this notion of Soviet nostalgia, generational identity is like one of this like the key independent variables, and why you decided that you make it clear why language is certainly not going to be your explanatory variable, but like why not something more like class or patronage or something like that?
This generational clash between the Soviet mindset and a post-Soviet mindset and more modern view of the world is something I encountered, of course, everywhere in the former Soviet Union. And in some places, for example, in the Baltic countries, the post-Soviet mindset was overcome much, much faster, although it also still exists in those places. And for me, what was interesting was when I was in the Donbas at the beginning of the insurgency in 2014, talking to people, and these are the people that were activists that were protesting in favor of Russia, talking to them, talking to some of the more thoughtful ones, it was quite interesting because I realized they actually didn't want to go to Russia. They wanted to go back to the Soviet Union. And I tried to show in my book that the Donbas, of course, was a very, very special place. And I do think it's worth recalling that the Donbas in the Soviet Union, especially the early years of the Soviet Union, was seen as one of the industrial engines. And until oil and gas were discovered in Siberia, Donbas was really one of the industrial centers of the Soviet Union. And so they saw themselves in the Soviet Union as a privileged class, and they had a lot of benefits and, for example, had access to cars. It was much easier for the miners to buy cars than for other Soviet citizens. So they saw themselves as privileged. And I tried to show that independent Ukraine for many of those people was seen as a huge loss. They lost their status. And certainly class does also work into this because it's a working class region, and they saw themselves lose a status that they had in the Soviet Union. So they didn't know very much about Putin's Russia. All they knew was that Putin's Russia was much richer than Ukraine. And in some ways, according really to a lot of indicators, was doing much better. And so that's what they found attractive. They found a return to the Soviet past attractive. And that's what I found sort of, for me, it really clarified that idea. And I think this is something I encountered also in Russia. I think in Russia, the perfect example is Moscow, where you have a new generation that came of age with the internet and thought it was completely natural to travel around the world and really saw itself as part of a global community, and then going outside of Moscow and people seeing people who were and meeting people who were very much stuck in sort of the Soviet past, and again were nostalgic because the Soviet Union had given so much more meaning to their lives compared to what they had in the post-Soviet time. So I think in that sense, it is a defining for Russia, and it is defining for Ukraine. Also because Ukraine and Russia together, they were the two core republics of the Soviet Union. And now it would be more and more difficult, obviously. But certainly at the time when I started traveling to Ukraine 20 years ago, you could find plenty of people that were nostalgic. And I don't want to say nostalgia is necessarily I don't think it's exclusively a bad word. I think there were Ukrainians who accomplished great things for the Soviet Union as their country in, for example, in technology, in the arts, and in many other fields. So there was a Soviet identity as well in Ukraine. I think we have to recognize that. And Putin tried to exploit it, existing nostalgia in Ukraine for his own purposes. And what he didn't realize was that this new generation in Ukraine had come of age that certainly didn't have nostalgia for the Soviet Union and certainly didn't see themselves wanting to join Putin's Russia.
If it comes down to generational shifts and so on, what do you see for the future? Or has the war sort of upended that? Because in theory, if younger people are less and less inclined toward Soviet nostalgia, does that then, I guess like in Ukraine, it's fairly obvious that the invasion has put a damper on you know, pro-Russian sentiment. But in Russia, let's say, do you think future generations is, do you still have a kind of great hope in the youth, or has the war and the kind of return to really straightforward authoritarianism, has that put the whole country on a different path and there's no reason for generational hope anymore?
Well, yes, I absolutely agree, Kevin, that as far as Ukraine, Putin is the one that really put the nail in the coffin of any Soviet nostalgia. And I mean, we saw that already after 2014 with the Leninopard, right? With the falling of all these Lenin statues all over Ukraine. So I think that is maybe one of his truly great accomplishments in Ukraine. As far as Russia, there was obviously a large exodus when mobilization immediately after the full-scale invasion started, and then when mobilization came. And obviously we saw tens of thousands of young Russians leaving. But of course, the majority of them are still there. They are still in their country. We don't know what they're thinking. We know that the people who think that the war is a good idea are probably in a minority. It's just that the rest of the society has been unable to express its opinion, or maybe even is still ambivalent toward the war. But the young generation is still there. And I don't know if it's a cause for hope necessarily. It's hard to be optimistic these days, but certainly there is a generation, and I think this is really the most significant point, is that there is a generation in Russia that has been denied a voice. Russia is being run really by a group of old men. There was never any generational transfer, for example, even Medvedev would have been a generational transfer if he had stayed in office. Of course, I'm thinking more of Mikhail Khodorkovsky or Alexei Navalny. There was never any real transfer. So what we're seeing right now in Russia is it's a small clique of old men running the country, and they're certainly, in my opinion, not representative of the rest of Russia.
Thanks for listening, folks. That's this week's show. As always, check out Meduza's homepage for our reporting on Russia, Ukraine, and the surrounding region. Share this podcast with your friends and enemies if you want. Write a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're tuning in. Until next time.